The start of the week and plenty on the radio. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
He was always gracious in giving black people their due.
Yes.
And I met him once in Vegas very quickly, before you ask. And
he How was that, Sheila? Brief, but...
Well, no, he was eating all his peanut butter and butter and bacon sandwiches, so he was pretty obese at the time.
Okay.
But he was Elvis, you know, and he was just a nice guy.
You are always living in fear of being deported. Maybe we have been hearing of workplaces being raided, and you are thinking maybe you are going to be next. So that's a very difficult situation.
In general, I am finding the lack of clarity on testing to be very disturbing right now. We just don't know what's going on.
And we'll start in the afternoon on the live line, the horror on the streets of cities and towns in Ukraine.
And we've been hearing today from Ukrainian citizens who are now in Ireland, some of whom have been invited to Leinster House on Wednesday to listen to their president address the joint Houses of the Oireachtas. And some of whom are quite shocked to hear that the Russian ambassador, Yuri Filatov, has also been invited to Leinster House on Wednesday for that address. It was, in some cases, the very first they heard of it when we were in contact with them. And they really can't believe that they're going to have to share a space with Mr. Filatov in these circumstances, particularly in the wake of those scenes that we have seen coming from Ukraine overnight, those horrific, horrific scenes from Bucha of those bodies strewn around suburban streets. And as I say, horrific stories that are coming with them of what has been done to men and women and children in those areas by Russian soldiers as they take their leave from the suburbs of Kyiv. I'll bring in Michael first. Michael, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Michael, you're the director of the Ukrainian Crisis Centre here in Ireland. You are one of those who were invited to the Dáil on Wednesday.
Yes, I am. Yes, I'm one of the directors who was invited to the meeting in Leinster House this morning. Learning the Russian ambassador was invited, which is kind of maybe it's because of the timing with the emerging news from Bucha, from the Kyiv region, which is recaptured by Ukrainian army. But emotions is just overwhelming. It's hard to, you know, it's just hard to. I want to go. Don't get me wrong. I would like to wait because it's my president addressing the Irish Parliament, and I know the Irish Parliament was supportive to Ukrainians. We all know the actions of the Irish government, and we can all see on the streets, in the news, and in the same time, I feel like, you know, sharing the room, same space with the Putin, the Putin's people, like in the, you know, it's just very hard to overcome emotionally. My initial reaction was not to go at all, but I started thinking maybe it's not the right way. Maybe we actually have to be all there, Ukrainians, like, you know, maybe outside the parliament, maybe just to show how much we thankful to Ireland. Mm-hmm. And they show that we have to be, like, you know, feelings have to be there, like, you know. But at the same time, it just, you know, every Ukrainian today, I'm reading a lot of people who's in Ukraine now, they trying to overcome with what they see. We know what was going on.
Yeah.
We knew everything, but you can't be mentally prepared for those scenes, like, you know.
I know, and I understand that, you know, even the horrific scenes that we are all seeing on our social media and on our mainstream media, that it's nothing to what is being shown on Ukrainian media. Would that be right?
Well, it's showing that the Ukrainians, like, it is, like, you know, social media is everywhere the same. Like, you know, basically Ukrainians seeing what they see, maybe not in the main channels, because it's a little bit too much, even if for the, you know, to see, to graphic, they're too graphic, like, you know, they need nothing. I don't think anybody needs to describe anything anymore, what's happening in the region and what's the behavior, like, of the Russian army, like, you know, it's I don't understand. Russian ambassador was invited as the part of the diplomatic processes are in place, but I don't know. Do we have a moral right to invite them at all to share the space with them if they actively supporting what and they trying to hide out the truth and, like, you know, actually working for Russian propaganda?
Yeah, because of course that's what the Russians are saying today. They're saying that these pictures were staged, that these things did not happen, that what we're seeing with our own eyes can't be believed.
Michael there. Then Katie spoke to Zuryana.
Zuryana, you, we know from your name, you're Ukrainian as well, but you've lived in Ireland for quite a number of years now.
Yeah, 16 years.
Right. But obviously, you're looking at the footage and the videos and the images coming out of Ukraine, particularly over the last 24 hours.
Yes, exactly. And also, you know, some of my family is here, but also most of my family is back there. But it's not only the family, it's that collective trauma that I'm experiencing, you know, being connected with my people, with my countrymen, with my nation. And it is absolutely transpiring in the pain in the body. You know, it's very difficult to watch, but it's even more difficult not to watch because you need to know what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly can't imagine being in your position and seeing those kind of images from my home country and, you know, being able to do so little to help or to change what's happening. And you have connections as well, family connections in Bucha.
Yes. So my cousin moved to Bucha 10 years ago and she lived there with her husband and her children and her husband's mom for the past 10 years. Yeah. So they were very lucky to have fled on the first day of the war. But, you know, there were so many who weren't that lucky.
Yeah. And I know your cousin's oldest daughter, Oksana, she's with you now, Zuryana.
Yes, she is. Yes, she's with me now. Yeah.
And we know this because she's actually left us a voice message because she wasn't comfortable chatting in, because obviously English isn't her first language and she's only just arrived in Ireland. But she did want to talk about, you know, what has happened in her hometown. So I think we can listen to that voice note now.
Yeah. On February 24th, I was in Bucha. It was on these days that Russian began bombing Ukrainian cities, including Antonov Airport in Hostomel, which is 3 kilometers from my home. These were horrible sounds. I live on the 7th floor and my windows overlook the same airport. At around 5 p.m. on the 24th, we heard very loud noises over our house and saw shells flying towards the airport in the window. It was very scary. We immediately started packing and left Bucha. This was probably the last chance to get out of there. Many of my friends, neighbors with children stayed in Bucha. For 2 weeks they sat in the basements of buildings without communication, without water, without food. Volunteers who provided assistance were shot dead by the Russians. My friends fled Bucha 2 weeks after the start of the war. On the way to evacuation, she saw the bodies of civilians, children on the ground. Some of them were being eaten by dogs. Green corridors created for people to live safely were also shelled. Our neighbor's car came under fire during the evacuation. One bullet got stuck in the seat where the child was sitting. It was very difficult for me yesterday when I saw hundreds of scary photos from Bucha, killed, torn people and children, raped young children and women, murdered men with their hands tied. I recognize many places in the photo, but it is very difficult to comprehend that this happened on the street of a peaceful and beautiful town which has not done anything to Russia or Russian people. Every day I go to a local news group for Bucha town and read messages where people are looking for their parents, children, friends. More than 1,000 messages today. Russian took everything from us. Hundreds of civilians were killed. Millions are forced to flee their homes. I'm very grateful to Ireland for sheltering Ukrainians and for sympathizing with the Ukrainian people. We are very grateful to you.
Oksana from The Liveline with Katie Hannan. Then later on The Ray Darcy Show, Ray was also talking about the pictures coming from Ukraine.
And that picture that's on the cover of all the papers today is going to become one of those sadly iconic photographs. The lady walking through the streets of Bucha, which is 35 kilometres north of Kiev, and to her left there are charred trees. The road which she's walking on is covered in black, wet ash. And to her right are blown out military vehicles, including a tank, and it looks like a personnel carrier, and it looks like a car there. And it's just so horribly bleak and desolate and destructive and violent and horrible. And so many people, when they see photographs like that, they want to act, they want to do something. Well, a group of lads from Wicklow have been doing their bit over the last while. We're joined on the line by Joe Morrison now, who's out on the Polish and Ukrainian border with two friends, Philip Flynn and Richie Murray. How are you doing, Joe?
Hey, well, Ray, yeah, I think it's the first time I've been on the radio using my own voice now, but
I should tell them, Joe, just so they know that you and I go way back, and you were Socky's minder, for want of a better way of putting in the day.
So
yourself and the lads are out in Poland / Ukraine, and are you the second shift or the third shift?
That's why we're the third shift now. It's kind of done in relay teams with a bit of an overlap. Sometimes there might be six of us here in two vans, but I'll explain how it happened in the first place. Mm. Like us all, absolutely appalled, sitting down, watching the news there a few weeks ago, the 6-1 news, and a WhatsApp group, a WhatsApp came in from pals at work explaining they were heading to Poland, renting a van, and whilst they were here, and getting involved in humanitarian aid delivery, a bit like Tesco click and collect, really, whatever the needs be, that need would be serviced. Mm. I flew over to Krakow here in Poland last Wednesday on the 30th, on day six now, and we've kind of got into a bit of a routine.
Now, you decided to do it differently than other people, because I was reading there over the weekend, for example, that Luke O'Neill and his mates got into a van and drove, and you're doing it a little bit differently.
Yeah, that's it. There's a cost involved in getting the van, driving a van from Ireland, filling it up with stock and getting here, which is still a great thing to do. It's an alternative way of doing it. But the approach that we took was, we'll hire our van over here, which is reasonably cheap to do, and we can fill it with goods that are needed in the moment. So, for example, we visited a refugee centre 2 days ago, and the washing was piling up. They were short a dryer. So we went out and we bought a dryer, so at least it can speed up the drying of the clothes.
What are you doing right now, as opposed
I'm in a Sheshov at the moment in our guest hostel, I suppose you'd call it. I was just finished sorting out a load of power banks and leads. So the power banks for mobile phones, which are really valuable for the for Ukrainian refugees coming over the border and in the their accommodation themselves before they decide where they're going to go in the world. At least they can. Basically, the chargers in the places is plug extension, flex, extension, flex, extension, flex. A load of phones plugged in, trying to charge them up before they go on their journey in the trains, the buses, their planes. This way, they have a battery pack which charges their phone as a backup, you know. Also, like when we were delivering the battery packs, well, look, do you have any headphones? Okay, we hadn't thought of that. Let's go out and get a load of headphones.
Right, so you're on the ground and fulfilling the need as you see it.
Joe Morrison on The Ray D'Arcy Show. And in the morning, the current COVID situation. The WHO's Dr. David Navarro was talking to Claire Byrne.
Now, reports this weekend suggest that a fourth COVID-19 vaccine dose is likely to be offered to as many as 4 million people at the same time as the winter flu vaccination. While opinions differ as to the peak of the Omicron wave and whether we've passed it here. For more on all of this, I'm joined now by Dr. David Navarro, the World Health Organization's special envoy on COVID-19. Dr. Navarro, thank you for joining us once again.
Very good morning to you and to listeners. Thank you.
What's your assessment, David, of the Omicron wave and where it might be at?
So, thank you. The waves that we see are a result of a virus that is affecting people and at the same time, people with varying degrees of resistance to the virus. After you've had COVID or after you've been vaccinated, there is a waning of the protection, or what we call immunity, to subsequent infections. And by waning, what I mean is, after some months, your body's immunity diminishes and you are susceptible again. So what tends to happen is that we get these waves of disease about every 3 to 4 months, and they reflect both those seriousness of the virus and the degree to which immunity is reduced. So right now, it is my belief that in Western Europe, the current Omicron surges are picking up again, partly because of a slight change in the character of the virus and the waning immunity. And I suspect it'll go on for a little bit more time before it reaches its next peak and then comes down again.
Because we are told here by some of our politicians, Leo Varadkar, the Taoiseach, that we're close or even past the second Omicron wave here in Ireland. Stephen Donnelly is our health minister. He said, he was quoted in the papers yesterday as saying Ireland could be past the peak of the current BA2 wave. Mm. What do you see in the Irish situation?
So the first thing is that we look at the numbers of people with reported infections. But the difficulty is that testing has changed in many countries recently, so the case numbers themselves may be deceptive. Secondly, we look at what's happening in hospitals. And thirdly, we look at figures for people being severely ill or dying. And the current situation, as I understand it, in Ireland, is that the numbers are high, but the thing that I particularly pick up is that the percentage of tests that were positive in Ireland in the week up to last Friday, the figure I have is 38%. Now, that suggests that probably this surging that we've got at the moment is a bit more serious than what we're picking up in the numbers of cases. Because with 38% positive rate, it probably means that if you tested more widely, you'd pick up an awful lot more cases. I suspect that we can't really say that the problem has been peaked or has peaked or is past. I'd say we're just pretty much in the midst of it.
Yeah, you just said a little earlier about this wave that comes, David, every 3 to 4 months. Is there a reason for that timeline?
Well, thank you. It's because of the rate at which immunity declines after people have been infected or vaccinated. Some people, and we can't really tell which of them, seem to have decreased protection quite quickly. Their immunity wanes fast, particularly older people. That's why we get some people in any community who tell us that they've got COVID for the second time in 6 or 7 or 8 months. They're the people whose immunity has dropped quickly. And it just seems that right now, partly because the variant BA2 has the capacity to get around our vaccine defences quite well, but partly also because you've got a lot of older people who've had several months since their last vaccination, there seems to be quite a susceptibility in European populations, which is why we are going into another wave. It's that balance between how susceptible are we and how nasty is the virus.
Dr. David Nabarro of the WHO from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the morning, Ryan Tuberty was reflecting on a moving and magical weekend climbing Crowpatrick with Charlie Bird.
I will begin by referring to that weekend that just went by, because it was an extremely hectic weekend. It was a very beautiful weekend. And it was a weekend like no other I've ever had in my life, I'll be honest with you. We finished the Late Late Show on Friday, which in itself was a bizarre mountain to climb. It was a lot of pressure trying to sing with Michael Bublé. It's like a pea shooter trying to fire at a Sherman tank. And the tank won, but, you know, it was fun getting there. So that was a whole heap of fun. He's a very nice fella. But then, of course, Siobhan McSweeney was also tremendous company. You'll know her from Derry Girls and so on. But then we had headed towards our chat with the great Barry McGuigan, who I've really grown very fond of, and if he doesn't mind me saying so, quite close to in recent years. And we then, myself and Barry, made our way to Mayo on Saturday morning with Danielle, my friend and colleague, and we got there just they left a little early, so myself and Barry had to do a little run for the first part. That was nice, no pressure at all there. No pressure trying to keep up with Barry McGuigan jogging up Crowpatrick at all. I was fine. I got 4 hours sleep. I was great. And he's only, what has he ever done anyway? He's not that fit. I mean, anyway, we got there and we caught up with the gang. And there was something very beautiful happening on Crowpatrick on Saturday. Everywhere I looked, I saw joy and I saw happiness and I saw a lot of tears. And I saw a lot of love. I'm not really a religious guy, but I can see what Charlie Bird meant when he said he's become more spiritual, because it there's something about that the reek, you know. It's a special place. It's Crowpatrick. It has its reasons, and it probably emits some class of some sense of spirituality, perhaps if that's your thing. But you can certainly see, as somebody who likes to observe humanity in all its glory, you could see it there in a very beautiful way. And the sun came out, and then very quickly the sun went away and the cold rain came down to remind us how human we are. And that didn't last too long, to be honest with you, because then the sun came out again. And by the time we all made our way up to the top of the reek, the sun was shining, the Clubé pipe band started to play, Daniel and Charlie and myself gathered around his family, Claire and his daughters and his grandchildren. Charlie cried and cried and cried. And I urged him, I said, there's a shoulder there if you need it. Get busy. And Claire said, I think I said at one point to Claire, tell me they're happy tears, Claire. She said, they're happy tears. I said, okay, good. He's crying happy tears. He was overwhelmed by the enormity of it. It was such an achievement for him, physically, personally, but also just for his soul. I think it was something really, really important. He said some beautiful words at the top of the mountain, as did Daniel O'Donnell. And people, we did photographs up and down, constantly up and down the mountain, which was all part of it. And I saw people fall. It's almost biblical. You saw people falling. And other people would go up to them and give them a hand. There was this lovely sense of community humans at their best, Ireland at its most gorgeous, especially when they realise that they just hit 2 million euro donations. Don't forget that in the middle of it all, for the Irish Motor and Neuron Disease Association and Pieta. So at so many levels, the micro level of somebody falling, can I help you? Take my arm, take my hand. There's what's called the shale, which is the brittle bit of stone and rock, which goes on for, again, it's like dog ears. It felt like it was going on for hours and hours. It was only probably about 20 minutes, but you put your foot on a bit of it and that gives way. So you go back a couple of steps to go back up. I mean, this is part of the, isn't that the lessons you learn from the mountains? Like life. Sometimes you go back a few steps. Sometimes you go forward. Sometimes you need help. You know, it's a metaphor, isn't it? And that shale part of it was tough. That's where I'd like to thank the number of people I slipped down through the rocks and land on. I landed on. You just land on people, particularly people who had sticks because they were able to prop themselves up. So I'd land on them. Thankfully, there's not a whole heap of me to land on anyone. So I don't think I caused them any physical pain. Maybe psychological scars, but certainly they were. You were a great help. It was a joy. I think I met people from every county in Ireland on that mountain. And I think that Charlie was mission accomplished. He said he was going to do it. He said he was going to raise money. He said he was going to raise awareness. He said he was going to bring us all with him. Take a bow. It was a beautiful story. I was chronicling it all on Instagram because otherwise it didn't happen. And that the response on that was lovely. And thanks to everybody for looking at it and donating. So thanks, everybody, for such a lovely welcome and for being part of that story. As I say, I've never felt or seen anything like it in my life. So, I hope you got something from it as much as I did.
Ryan Tuberty in the morning. And today with Claire Byrne began with a look at the worsening situation in Ukraine.
But first this morning, the retreat of Russian forces around Kiev has left horrifying evidence of atrocities against civilians littered across the region's suburbs and towns. As Ukrainian armoured columns rolled into Bucha, a town northwest of the capital, they found the streets blocked by burned out Russian tanks and military vehicles and strewn with the bodies of civilians, whom locals said had been killed by the invading forces without provocation. In the southeast of the country, the stricken city of Mariupol, which has been surrounded by Russian forces for more than a month and suffered some of the war's worst attacks, conditions there remain dire and prospects for escape uncertain. But first, I'm joined by Liz Cookman, freelance journalist and contributor to the AFP news agency. And Liz, first of all, that situation in Bucha and other areas near the capital city, Kiev, what's the latest you're hearing?
Essentially, Russian forces retreated, and when Ukrainian forces went in, they found a lot of destruction, but also a lot of bodies that had not been accounted for. There were mass graves. There were people lying in the streets having been burnt. In some places, some people seem to have been executed. And Human Rights Watch also documented a case of repeated rape.
And the number of people killed, that hasn't been verified yet, because, of course, the fear is that there'll be further discoveries of bodies.
Yes, so there was one mass grave of 30 people discovered. And the mayor of Bucha also said that they'd had to bury 410 people that they'd found lying in the streets.
And I'm sure the expectation is that this horror will be repeated once Ukrainian forces can get into other parts that were targeted.
Yeah, a lot of people are very fearful for what will be found in Mariupol if that's liberated. Of course, it might not be. It might end up staying under Russian occupation. But the situation in Mariupol is very, very bad indeed. And it's been cut off for around a month now. And basically, there's heavy fighting in the streets as well as endless aerial bombardment. People, I'm in Zaporozhye, which is the first part of Ukrainian held territory from Mariupol. It's the city where the people who are escaping Mariupol come to register, to get a night's sleep, to get some food before they head on towards the west. And people I've been speaking to have painted a very, very grim picture of life in Mariupol. One woman I spoke to last night said that when they tried to leave, there was a group of 20 neighbours. When they came out from the basement, the first two that came out were shot. I spoke to a woman who said that her friend had to kill her family dog to feed her children. There's also reports of there of many, many, many bodies lying in the street unaccounted for. So people are very worried about the death toll there.
How did they get out, those people you spoke to last night?
So there's been a lot of attempts to establish a humanitarian corridor that have all failed. At the moment, the only way to get out is to physically get yourself to Melikina, which is a nearby village. And then from there, there are volunteers taking cars to try and help people get out. And you can also pay people to take you out on a car. But to get to Melikina, it's in some cases a 20, 25, 30 kilometer walk. And the particular worry is for the elderly and for the disabled who find it very difficult to get out. They don't have the means to get out. Some people have said that people have frozen to death in their homes because they couldn't get out. And there's no water, there's no food, there's no electricity. So people who are vulnerable, it's a particularly difficult situation.
And we have heard on this programme in the last number of days that there aren't any aid agencies in Mariupol. It's simply, I would imagine, too dangerous to try and get in there. But are there any aid agencies in the outskirts, even in Zaporizhia, helping people once they do get out?
Yes. Yeah, so the Red Cross has a presence here. I've seen a lot of aid coming in from Poland, from various different groups. And the Red Cross have also been trying to get to Mariupol. They had a couple of failed attempts. They're still trying. And I've also spoken to a number of individuals who are the only people, in fact, taking in aid. So there are people who are from Mariupol who themselves have fled, or perhaps people who have family who are trapped there. And they take private cars packed with as many supplies as they can gather, and they take those in, and then they bring people out when they return.
Reporter Liz Cookman. And Claire also spoke to Ukrainian MP Vladimir Ariev.
Ukrainian MP Vladimir Ariev from the European Solidarity Party joins me now from Kiev. Vladimir, thank you for joining us this morning. The photographs and the images that have been shared around the world of Bucha are haunting, disturbing, very upsetting. Can you tell us how you feel seeing those images?
Well, I can't describe the feeling I have, because the massacre Russian made in Bucha, Irpin, and smallest towns on the western part of Kyiv suburbs. This is really horrible. And if we have a new Srebrenica story in 21st century, that this is it, what we have. I'm really in shock, and we in Kyiv predicted that something horrible happened there, but we couldn't estimate the real tragedy happening in these towns. It was very pretty and prosperous towns. Bucha, 30,000 inhabitants lived there, and at least now, at the first counting, more than 300 were found killed, and this is far from the end of counting dead bodies. And we can't estimate how many people were buried in mass graves that were found on charge Kurdia in Bucha. So we are going on with estimating what happened there. It's real disaster.
Vladimir, is the belief that most men between the ages of 16 and 65 in Bucha, is the belief that they were killed?
Russian killed all possible men they could found there. Of course, some men from this age remain alive because they were hiding in everywhere possible to hide and not appear in front of Russian soldiers. But you know that there are not only men. The tragedy that boys, even less than 16 years, were killed by shot in back with hands with rope on their hands. It's, you know, this is something bestial, what the pictures from Bucha, which is circulating now in our media. And
of course. And Vladimir, the expectation must be, and the fear must be, that this scene will be repeated in other towns, in other cities in Ukraine.
I do think that we don't know what the real situation in Mariupol, what can happen there after the entering Russian troops in Mariupol. The signals are really very bad, and also the horrible stories we've heard from suburbs of Kharkiv, Chernihiv, and Sumy on the northern and northern east part of Ukraine. And you know, this story will be repeated in much more big scale if Russia back to attack any Ukrainian territories.
Vladimir Ariev from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the morning, one of the most popular singing acts of the 1970s and 80s was the Three Degrees. And Sheila Ferguson was always up front and centre for all their hits. She was in fine fettle when she met Ryan Tuberty in the morning.
I love getting up in the morning.
Oh, you love it, don't you? You bounce in here like a spring chicken saying,
absolutely.
Oh, I wish it was on earlier.
I wish
I was on Morning Ireland talking about something else. I'd love to be on Morning Ireland talking about Donald Trump, my favourite president.
Oh, don't you mention him. How dare you mention him. No.
Triggered.
No Putin and no Trump.
Okay.
All right.
Is that it? They
no, anything else is on the table, but no Putin and no Trump.
In fact, I have your contract details here for our interview.
May
and it
I
says
say
that
to your listening audience, ladies and gentlemen, I've been listening to this gentleman for the last half hour, even though a lot of it was depressing, a lot of it was very uplifting, and I just want to say that you have a wonderful demeanor when you speak to your audience.
You're thoughtful.
And people should really appreciate
it.
Oh
my goodness. Okay, well, that's very kind. I'm talking to Sheila Ferguson, who is what we call in Ireland a divil. Do you know what that means?
A divil?
Yeah, a divil.
No, I never heard that.
It means you're, there's another word I'd use, is a messer.
Messer.
So I know, I'm not getting any. I don't know what the American word for this is. It's somebody who's like a
gift of the gab.
Yeah, and a bit of a somebody who causes a bit of trouble at the back of the class.
A devil in Prada.
Yeah, indeed, or whatever your jacket you're wearing, which could
be. Well, no, polo, you know.
So. Welcome to Ireland.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here.
It's so nice to talk to you. Obviously, you were the this great singer from the Three Degrees, but you're still singing. So we've got so many places to go here. But where I'd like to land on, if you don't mind, to begin with our conversation, is Philadelphia.
Okay.
And the reason I want to do that is because I'll come to the end in the end, but at the beginning,
I'll follow you.
You had a lot of moving around as a young person.
Yes, I did.
And it was unsettling because you, at one point, as I understand it, you obviously you're academically,
yep,
you were gifted. You thought about psychology. You thought, yep, about, I presume, third level education and, yep, everything like that. Why all the moving?
My mother was mentally ill, and there was a time when she couldn't look after me.
Yeah.
And I was then shoveled out to different aunts and uncles every 2 weeks. So obviously, if I had to move, my clothes were in a cardboard box for a long time. And I would have to obviously change schools. So change and fitting in has always been a way of life with me. Going on tour is the same as my childhood.
Just nothing's changed.
Nothing's
you know,
nothing
from Philadelphia
changed
to Dublin, you're still moving the
exactly,
whole time.
Exactly,
How old, I'm just trying to get into the mind of a child with a mother who's got a mental illness of some of this sort. How old are you when do you believe six. That a child can comprehend that something is not the same as all the other?
Oh, I knew between 5 and 6 because I was the one who called the police to help my mother. And when you see your mother being taken off in a straitjacket, you grow up very quickly. And you kind of assimilate a lot of things in a very short period of time. It's to the point now when I meet someone, the first 7 seconds, I knew I liked you.
Oh, that's
ditto. It's body language. Yeah. It's your first impressions. Yeah. And usually, as Maya Angelou once said, when somebody shows you who they are, listen.
Yeah.
And I do. I really know that if they start putting on a facade after that, it's too late. I already sussed them.
Okay, so I see where the psychologist didn't go too far away from the tree, if I can mix my metaphors. So do you get that, because we do a show here at Christmas time, which involves children and so forth. Do you get that? And I'd meet the kids and whatever. Can you spot a kid who's maybe in a bit of trouble? Or
yes, I can.
Has got a bit of a weight on the show? Can
yes,
you?
Yes, I can.
How does that work, I wonder?
It's not something I can actually put my fingers on. Sometimes it's lack of eye contact because they know that you see through them.
Mm.
Sometimes it's acting out. As a parent, we all know how kids act out when they act out. There's always a reason.
Yeah.
And I'm one of those kind of mothers who was I would tongue lash them to death. They would say, "Oh, mommy, just hit me, please. Don't talk to me anymore." I said, "Oh, no.
Yeah.
You must listen to me. Oh, God, please." You know, so I believe in talking them to death and explaining to them why they're in the wrong. And this is why you will not go into my footsteps. Because at one point, one of my twin daughters, I won't name, when they get older, you can't name who they are.
Yes.
And one said, "We know why you're so wild. You're so strict." I said, "Why?" "Because you were wild." I said, "Exactly. That's why you're not going to be. And the exorcist is coming out of me."
So when you hear the exorcist voice, you know you're in trouble.
When they hear the exorcist voice, they know, man.
And Ryan asked Sheila about being a shy child and beginning to sing in front of audiences.
I remembered always being at the dinner table when the family would have family gatherings. And I could see when everybody started looking at me like, "Oh, God, they're going to ask me to sing." So they knew that I could sing, but they knew I was shy and didn't want to sing.
Right.
So one of my aunt, bless her heart, she passed during the first lockdown, and we had a virtual funeral, which was hell because I had to cry alone, you know, because I was in lockdown here.
Yeah.
And anyway, she said, "Wheelie," that's my nickname, "Wheelie." I said, "What?" She said, "You're going to be singing at the church for the tea." I said, "First of all, I don't want to go to church. And second of all, I don't like tea." So she said, "This is not negotiable."
Oh, yeah.
I thought she'd forget about it. And one day she said, "Now, put your ribbons on." I thought, "Oh, God, I'm stuck." So I sang the Lord's Prayer a cappella. And all the ladies went, "Hey, oh, sweet child, sweet child." And after that, I lost my fear of singing in front of people.
It took that moment. But
that was the moment I can remember.
Was it a big leap into the Grand Canyon in the hope that there'd be a net underneath?
No, it was me shaking at the knees and just saying, "Well, I got to sing before these old people. Let me get it over with." And but after I heard my voice out loud in the church, I remembered thinking, "Well, it's not so bad," because they clapped. even though it was a polite clap.
Did you get a dopamine hit from the applause by any chance?
No. It was just a small group. I got the pride of looking at my aunt feeling that she was proud of me.
Nice,
and that meant more to me than anything else for her to be proud.
I was watching Summer of Soul, that documentary. I'm sure you've seen it. And
that's brilliant.
I was watching Mahalia Jackson and I was thinking, you know, the church and religion, and I'm talking about music, not the the spirituality.
Yeah, me
that's
too.
For another show. The music that came out of those churches all around, maybe the South particularly, for whatever reason, seems to have fed rock and roll.
Well, it did. And I mean, you know, Elvis stole it from us. You know, not that I want to go into that, but
So Elvis was watching Jackie Wilson and saying, "I can move like that, I can sing like that,
but you can't go there.
But you see,
but I know you can't.
But the world is kinder, history has been kinder to Elvis.
Your love's lifting me higher than I've ever been lifted before.
It's a great tune, as you know. And then Elvis comes, "Your love's lifting me."
But he captured the audience.
That's it.
He was always gracious in giving black people their due.
Yes.
And I met him once in Vegas very quickly, before you ask. And
how was that, Sheila?
brief, but...
Well, no, he was eating all his peanut butter and butter and bacon sandwiches, so he was pretty obese at the time.
Okay.
But he was Elvis, you know, and he was just a nice guy.
And Ryan asked Sheila about meeting Marvin Gaye.
Well, that was my first gig at the Apollo Theatre, and I was 14, and I was singing my first single, When Will I See... My first single, Little Red Riding Hood. And I was nervous because this is like the Apollo where everybody was launched. And if they didn't like you, I heard they threw tomatoes at you.
Wow.
And I'm ready to be hit with tomatoes, you know. And I had nowhere near the confidence I have now. Nowhere near. Yeah. So I went to Marvin Gaye's. He was at the top of the bill and my name was at the bottom. And I went to his dressing room to before I could finish knocking at the door because I kept backing off like I'm not going to do this. He opened it. He said, Sheila, come on in. I went, you know, and he'd look like a god in that blue satin costume with the ruffled shirt and the bow tie. And he sat down, and we talked, and he was so nice.
Right.
And he put me at my ease knowing that I was nervous. And that's something I've carried with me all of my
Lovely.
Career.
What a great skill.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he signed my autograph. And do you know that we stayed friends until he died
Did
in
Did you really?
Indeed.
A gentleman, then.
Very much so. But I remembered thinking, now, once we hit the height of our fame, I remembered seeing people who kind of knew who I was, and even still, and they didn't know what to do. And I always extend my hand and say, hi, nice to meet you. Because it puts them at their ease, because he did that to me.
What a nice
lesson. So if you take the good things that life shoves at you and put them all together, you can do some good.
Sure.
And I like doing good. I like teaching and I like doing good.
Could you have been a teacher in another life?
I got
that sense from you. And what subjects would you like to teach? Or?
Actually, anything. Apparently, all my cousins say, I used to sit them down and make the, after school to make them be my pupils.
Did you really?
I did.
What a nerd.
I know. Isn't that terrible? Ruins my whole reputation. My sex life is gone forever now.
Actually, speaking of which, you did say at one point...
Too early for that. Never too early. As you were saying.
This is quite the morning. As I was
saying. So I've heard that before. You're going to be put off the air now.
I think we were
He's
shut
a very
down
gorgeous
minutes
guy,
ago.
Ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. I heard him say he's married with a 10-year-old son. But let me just tell you, he's a hottie.
You got, as I say.
He's turning red now.
I am, yeah. You have me bright red.
As you were saying?
I've been told I have a great face for radio. So you won't see me on stage
so
with you
with
soon.
Jesus.
Okay, so we're back to your sex life. You said at one point, which was that Prince Charles kind of ruined your mojo because...
Well, I mean...
What happened?
Everybody believed that we were lovers.
What?
When we weren't.
How did that happen?
That was a song I recorded. How did that happen? He did make several moves, but I didn't take him up on it. You know, I wasn't going to be a notch on his bedpost. I always figured that they'll sleep with you, but they won't marry you. So there's no future in it because I'm a good girl. I am. But you know, it was nice having him flirt, and I gave him toe to toe, and I think he liked that because I didn't kowtow.
Yeah,
he would say, "I have a train." I say, "Yeah, well, I got a plane." I didn't, but I had to have a comeback. You know, I had to have a comeback. I'm from the ghetto, you know. So he just laughed. He said, "Sheila, you're something else." I said, "Yeah, so were you." You know, so I always toe to toe him, I think he liked being treated like a normal guy, not like the future king of England, which never dawned on me at all.
Yeah.
But that would have put me off even further, you know, because I realized then. Because we people don't realize it, but we did charity work for every member of the royal family, not just Charles.
Yeah.
And there is a cult within the women in the organization, and I think some of them believed that Charles was having a thing, because I got snubbed at once, and I said to the girls, Okay, so they believe it too.
Yeah.
And they said, yeah, we see it.
Okay.
So it's very interesting. It's very subtle.
Okay. But you had it sounds like you had a really kind of fun, flirtatious relationship with him as opposed to anything else.
It was just so quick. It's just the press made it such a big deal.
Well, as they can do.
And we met two or three times. We all went to see him play polo. He showed me his XJS and all of our cassettes were, remember them?
Yeah.
Cassettes were in the middle and he was a fan.
Ah, great. Great. That's Sheila Ferguson on the Ryan Tuberty Show. Now, documenting the undocumented in Ireland. Claire Byrne was talking about a new scheme with the Justice for the Undocumented Group and the Migrants' Rights Centre. Albert Bello and Irene Jagoba were telling Claire their stories.
Irene, I want to start with you because when I was reading about your story, I was really struck by the fact that you've been in Ireland for 14 years and you haven't seen your children in all that time.
Yeah, that's right. Good morning.
Tell me a little bit about that. When did you arrive and why did you come to Ireland?
So I came to Ireland in 2008 because my son has a heart condition. So I said I want to join my sister and try to work here for a short period of time while visiting Ireland. So I started working, and it's only a 3-month permission, and it wasn't enough, you know. And I decided to overstay here in Ireland to work and to support my son's medication, my children's education, support my family, and to sustain and support my life here in Ireland. So I overstayed and worked and become undocumented until now. And I haven't been at home for over 14 years now. I haven't seen my kids since I left.
How old were your children, Irene, when you left?
8 and nearly 2. Nearly 2, yeah.
That must have been... it must be incredibly difficult for you.
It is very difficult leaving them, and one is not in a very good condition. It is heartbreaking, but I have to make that decision.
The reason you stayed here, Irene, was so you could afford his medication.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Because he was in the hospital for very long, and I spent everything I have for him to survive, to fight for his life.
Albert, will you talk to me a little bit about your situation? You've been here for 6 years.
It's a very difficult situation living undocumented, considering the fact that you always live in fear. You can't travel back home to see your relatives and come back. It's a very difficult condition. And I personally lost my brother 3 years ago. I couldn't manage to travel and actually mourn with the rest of the family. So you can imagine how difficult it was.
Yes, absolutely. And you arrived here as a student 6 years ago, is that right?
Yes, I came as a student and possibly to get a job because life back home is very tough. So after a year of after 3 weeks of learning, my college got closed and we lost all the money that we invested in that. And then we are told to enroll in a fresh college, which I couldn't manage because the fees there was a bit higher than the one that we actually enrolled in the first place.
And you mentioned that life is very difficult when you're undocumented, and you both have struggled with the fact that you couldn't travel home. But your day-to-day life, Albert, how is it impacted here in Ireland by being undocumented?
It's a very difficult situation. Like I said, you are always living in fear of being deported. Maybe we have been hearing of workplaces being raided and you are thinking maybe you are going to be next. So that's a very difficult situation. But today we are very happy to have received the news, the positive news of actually the scheme, the results. So I'm very, very happy.
And Irene, I'm sure you're relieved as well that this day has come.
Yes. Yeah, it is incredible to see the first undocumented people receiving the life-changing news of the positive results from the scheme application after so long campaigning for this and hoping that this will build the confidence for those people who are still fearful to come out and kind of I hope they will take the courage to apply and get this lifetime, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to change their status. And I am really, like, I am overjoyed. I'm in cloud nine now that I am one of those people who received this positive news today. This stable status will... that we receive will allow us to finally leave safely and stand up for our basic rights. And for myself, in my personal, I will finally be able to visit my kids back home and come back to Ireland to live and work in a normal life without fear.
Irene Jagoba and Albert Bello from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the morning, architect Roisin Murphy was talking to Claire Byrne about the Simon Open Door event.
Okay, in return for €95 of a donation to the Simon community, you get an hour-long consultation with an RIAI registered architect, and you can talk about anything from building, renovating to retrofitting your home. And architects are giving it for free. So the money goes directly to the Simon communities. Which is, I think they have 8 regionally based communities in Cork and Dublin and all around the country.
Okay, and it's been running for 17 years and it goes, yes, of course, to help tackle homelessness. But for the person, yeah, who's making the donation, can you get, yeah, a good feel as an architect for what someone will need in just one consultation?
Yes. It's a really short answer, which you can, because I suppose architects are trained in your home, in your house. So particularly it was virtual for the last couple of years. So now you have face-to-face consultations. So they are obviously going to be reading you, getting to know you. So it's like going into your GP, except it's for homes and architecture. And people get an architect is an expert at living in the built environment, whether it is cities or whether it is your little home. And there's a lot of, we have a small problem with procurement of architects at the moment in Ireland, in that it's very complex for architects to get on lists for big contracts. So the pool of young, very talented architects available for this kind of service in Ireland is second to none. So you could get the next really big architect could be giving you your consultation.
Well, that's good news, that to know that there are architects available out there, because there's such a squeeze, yeah, on with construction that I think the assumption might be that there's no availability. We're going to get to some of your tips in a minute, but the thought, yeah, of extending can be really daunting for people. Does it have to, yeah, be a big job? Can you do an extension simply?
Oh, yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, I remember the movie My Left Foot, and you know when it's the brothers who are building the extension, she comes out and she's putting the... It's just bricks. We've been building since we were first human. So extension is very simple, but it's how you put it on. If you put it on jam on the back of the house and you don't take into consideration the daylight or the sunlight, you can make a problem in your house.
Roisin Murphy from Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.